The higher education landscape is changing all the time. The 14 state-owned universities of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education have experienced changes as much as any in the state and the country. For example, there were almost 120,000 students enrolled at the institutions in the fall of 2010. Today, it is closer to 93,000. PASHI is in the process of undergoing the biggest change in its 39-year history. The Board of Governors has unanimously approved the integration of six universities into two. What's behind the move, and what will the finished product look like? Joining us is Dan Greenstein. He was the Chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. Chancellor Greenstein, welcome to the program. Mansfield, Lock Haven, and Bloomsburg into one institution, California, Clarion, and Edinburgh in another. But maintaining the campuses and the schools' identities, what will this look like, or how will these six actually become two?
Good morning, Scott, and thanks for having me. Look forward to the conversation, obviously. So in both cases, we're following a similar trajectory where over the next year and a bit more, our faculty and staff will work together to sort of blend the various aspects of the university's business and operational processes, and also critically their curriculum. So from a student's point of view, a student at any one of those universities will have access to all of the wonderful on-site activities that occur, athletics, clubs, associations, et cetera, dorm life, the associational activities that a student takes on, plus the full scope of academic programs that are available across all three.
All right, well, let's talk about each one of those, kind of break them down. When you say administrative and operational, what does that mean? Does that mean one administration, faculty for all three?
Correct. Imagine a single president, a single set of vice presidents, a single set of deans, et cetera, but also the sort of the back end services, a single HR department, a single financial aid department, a single enrollment management approach and strategy, et cetera. So just imagine all of the kind of business, operational, student facing type functions, functions involved in sort of student recruitment, et cetera, all of them integrated into a single, operating entity, and then a single faculty, but obviously faculty distributed and staff distributed across all of the three universities.
When you say a single faculty, so that means, like, if I'm a student at Bloomsburg, but there is an instructor, a professor who is on the campus of Mansfield, they would be accessed, that class would be done remotely for 2/3 of those students?
So that would certainly be, yeah, absolutely. So that would certainly be one way to achieve that objective. But you could also imagine an English department with faculty at each of the universities, and so a considerable amount more of face-to-face instruction.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't quite understand. When you say quite a bit more face-to-face, what do you mean by that? Describe that, if you
will. So the general education curriculum is pretty much the first 2 years of a student's education, and that will be entirely face-to-face for all of our students. The other thing is we're designing what we call the academic program array, what programs are available where to whom, and we're designing it around the current distribution of our students. So if today's students were enrolled in tomorrow's university, 75% of all those students would find faculty on their campuses for the full scope of their degree programs. So we're really looking at online delivery for a minority of our students. But it also provides an opportunity for all of our students to access far greater range of courses, programs, minors, majors, areas of concentration than they could ever have done if the universities had remained independent.
With one faculty, one administration, obviously one of the reasons behind this is cost savings, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But will there be job losses? I mean, will there be fewer faculty? Will there be fewer administrators?
So at the point of integration, where from the time the universities become integrated, we are expecting some further losses, mostly in sort of management administrative ranks, not in the faculty ranks. Faculty should remain about consistent or grow to a small extent. Obviously, all of this is contingent upon enrollments. But that is the anticipation going forward with integration, that we're looking now to sort of turn the corner into growth.
If you're just tuning in, our guest is Dan Greenstein, Chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. And we're talking about a plan to integrate six universities into two. The ball is already in motion now. It's already started. But this would be first classes August 2022. Is that right, Chancellor Greenstein?
Yeah, I would think of it in terms of the first cohort of enrolled students joining the integrated entity in August 2022. Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about the reasons behind this integration or consolidation. What prompted it?
Well, so a number of things, but I would say the largest, the overriding factor is to expand student opportunity, but also opportunity for the communities in which these universities are located. So let me just unpack that a little bit. So the universities that we're talking about, the rural schools in particular, they are relied. First of all, they're wonderful. They're great places to be for our students. They have tremendous outcomes, and they're the most affordable option still in the state of Pennsylvania. So. And of course, they're relied upon by their communities for the full range of business leaders, healthcare providers, educators, et cetera, that those communities need to sort of thrive into the future. So they're doubly important to their communities. They create jobs. Obviously, that's tremendously important. But as importantly, they create the leadership of those communities in the future. They are relied upon to recruit that kind of leadership that enables those places to thrive. So it's essential that they are able to offer the broadest possible range of academic degree programs, majors, minors, et cetera. It's not enough just to have one flavor of business or healthcare education, because the communities rely on them for a variety of a breadth, if that makes sense. And of course, as enrollments decline, and they have declined 40 to 50% over the last 10 years in five of these six universities, it becomes impossible for those universities to maintain that academic program breadth. And that, of course, creates a real challenge, not just for the universities and the students who attend them, but also for their community. So that by integrating these institutions, we're able to expand the opportunity available to any of the students and the communities that they serve. And I'll give you an example. A place like Mansfield, if it were operating independently, you know, used to be able to offer 40, 45, 50 even academic programs, majors, minors, et cetera. On its current size and, you know, enrollments, it can offer maybe 20. As part of an integrated entity, it can offer 80. Right. So four times as many program areas are available to the students as would have been available should a Mansfield or a Clarion or an Edinburgh have maintained themselves on their own.
That's certainly a positive way to look at it. But I mean, isn't it true that all of this was, what got this set this in motion was basically economics, that, I cited those declining enrollment numbers, and yeah. And that's a big part of it. Isn't that true, that that's what really is behind the move here?
Well, not for me, Scott. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I'm an educator, not a businessman. And, so I'm interested in students. That's what I care about. And obviously the communities that they come from. And this is all about service to our students and our communities. And so, you know, obviously, if you do the right thing for our students, the finances will follow. But the primary emphasis here, the primary objective is to not just improve the student experience, but to expand student opportunity and ultimately to grow enrollments and to continue these very vibrant community organizations for well into the, 21st century and beyond.
But obviously, those declining enrollments have had an impact. I cited the numbers, 120,000 students in 2010, closer to 93,000 now. How has that impacted the state system?
Yeah, and again, I think I would lead with the student experience. So as universities' enrollments decline, the economics are of higher education not that complicated. You can only afford as many programs as you can enroll, as you can generate revenues. And our revenues, of course, 75% of them are paid by students through tuition fees, room and board, and the rest 25% comes from the state. So in that mix, as enrollment has declined, it's become impossible for our universities in these critical areas to maintain the full range of programs that their students and their communities need, frankly, and deserve. And so in order to ensure the students have the best possible opportunities and those communities have the best possible opportunities to grow and to thrive and to recruit their leadership, we focused on integration as a means of ensuring that.
27,000 fewer students in just over a decade.
Yeah.
Why are enrollments declining?
Well, it's a complex mix. I mean, so I think demographics obviously has a great deal to do with it, that our enrollments are declining at a rate which is reflective of the decline in the size of the high school leaving population. High school leavers make up about, 80 or 90% of our students. So that's an important factor. I would say affordability is probably the largest factor. So over time, as obviously state investment has deteriorated, over time, tuition fees, room and board have increased, and the total cost of attending a university has grown. And so the competitive advantage that a Pennsylvania State System University had once over, other options within Pennsylvania has declined. We're still the most affordable, but that gap has shrunk considerably. And so I would say that combination of factors has really obviously shown up in our enrollments as in other comparable institutions across the country.
We know that Pennsylvania, from discussions that we've had in the past and even some of your predecessors that I've had in the past, that Pennsylvania, probably the state provides less financial support than in other states. Would this be, I don't really want you to speculate, but I'm going to ask you to, if the state provided more funding, a higher percentage of funding, would this move be made?
That's impossible to speculate. I will say that, state funding is critical to ensuring that there are affordable opportunities for students in the state of Pennsylvania. I see this as a major threat to the economy of the state going forward, frankly. Economically, the 60% of all jobs require people in them with some form of post-secondary education. Currently, we're at like 48%. So we've got to grow the number of adults who have some form of post-secondary education. And the only way to do that is to ensure that low and middle income people from across the state have opportunities to achieve that. And that is itself based entirely on the availability of affordable pathways. And of course, they do not exist here in the same way that they do in other states, because the state is 48th in the nation in terms of its funding for higher ed. I'm going to just flip on that a little bit and say that I am absolutely delighted and grateful to the governor and to the General Assembly for the significant investment that they have just made in the state system, $200 million in one-time funding over the next 3 years, to enable us to really begin to turn this corner. Higher education is partnership. It requires universities and systems like ours, to manage themselves effectively, to be as best as they can for their students. And it requires the state to make that kind of investment. And so what you're seeing here is that partnership beginning to take root, that sort of new approach to partnership beginning to take root. And I'm excited by the future as a consequence of that.
Chancellor, we have an email here from Kit, who says, have you given any thought as to how these consolidations will affect the economies of the towns where the universities are located? Any pluses or minuses? You've touched on this, but what about that?
Yeah, sure. Great question. So we have done an economic impact study. In fact, we updated one that we did in 2014-15, I think. And so obviously, Scott, it won't surprise you or your emailer to know that the decline of enrollments has really severely affected our communities, mostly through the reduction of student spending in those communities. And that's something that we need to reverse. I mean, these communities are absolutely essential to the future of Pennsylvania. They're wonderful places. And they have, vibrant futures and great opportunities going forward if we're able to continue to work closely with them. Going forward, integration is the way to continue that vibrant economic life that our estimates and all of this is available from our website. PASHI.edu under the integrations work, you'll see that we anticipate that each of the communities will experience greater growth as a result of integration. In terms of economic impact of the communities will experience greater growth as a result of integration than they would had they remained independently.
What about choices for students? As you mentioned, these six universities are located mostly in rural areas. Yeah. But if I could compare two, for example, Bloomsburg and Mansfield, what happens if you don't get an equal distribution, or maybe you're not even looking for an equal distribution of applicants to those schools? But let's face it, Bloomsburg, which is one of only two towns in Pennsylvania, Bloomsburg is a larger municipality. There probably are more opportunities for students than, say, in a smaller town like Mansfield. Are you concerned, or have you looked into if students say, well, you know what, between these three, where I want to live, stay on campus, this is the one I'm going to choose, and more students decide to choose that way?
That's going on now, Scott. I mean, student choice is what determines, you know, distribution of enrollments, not just across the Pennsylvania State System schools, but across higher education in the country. And students are very different. You know, some do prefer to be in very large environments with 10, 15, 45,000 students, depending on the institution, and others to be in much more intimate circumstances, as in Mansfield. Mansfield is a destination university because of its location and because of the wonderful things that are going on there. The benefits that we have, and I'll use Mansfield and Bloom as an example, is that, you know, a Mansfield student is now part of an entity that has access to an ACSB accredited business school, the highest level of accreditation that you can possibly achieve, and a Bloom student has access to, for example, a music program at Mansfield, which is as good as they get in the state of Pennsylvania. So, you know, you're blending the best of in many ways, and of course that provides tremendous opportunities for students that just didn't exist before. And that really is, and the choices that they're making in terms of where physically, geographically, you know, et cetera, they want to live and work in their are no longer constrained by the academic program that any institution has, because the programs have been blended at integration and just have tremendously more opportunities for any student independently of where they might be.
Let's take a phone call from Joseph in Lancaster. Joseph, you're on Smart Talk.
Good morning. Your guest can spin it any way he wants, but the bottom line was, or is, it's the cut costs. I mean, it makes it sound like this was done for the student. The student really had plenty of opportunities at these colleges and that, but year in and year out, tuition went up above the inflation rate. Room and board went up, and after a while, people just said, "We just cannot afford this anymore." So I find it very hard to believe that this is for the benefit of the student.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your call. Chancellor, your response to that?
I respectfully disagree.
You don't want to add to that?
I think I've already done that, Scott.
Mm-hmm. So, but obviously cost savings are a big part of this. How much money will be saved under this plan?
So again, cost savings are really not the driving motivation. The real driving motivation is that as our universities have become more expensive, as they have experienced the political, demographic, and other pressures, they have contracted. And as they contract, they are unable to serve their students and those students' communities as well as they need to be served. And so that leaves them very few options if they want to flourish into the future. Obviously, significant reinvestment by the state would help considerably. And as we, you know, renegotiate that kind of relationship, integration provides the best path for ensuring that all of our students have the opportunities that they need. The projections, to answer your question specifically, are that the universities will save about $19 million after 5 years. That would be $19 million ongoing. And that's mostly in a shared reduced costs for, you know, services that they now share, single departments, mostly on the administrative side. And the reduction of personnel, again, mostly at the administrative levels.
We have a question from Ronald who asks, will each of the three schools only offer certain course of studies, or will they continue to offer the course of studies they have the last 3 or 4 years? If the three state schools will only be offering certain course of studies so they do not repeat majors, How does that affect athletics and the recruitment of student athletes? If a school is going to offer only certain majors and I'm trying to recruit a student athlete to play a sport at one of these three schools, how can I successfully recruit a student athlete? It's actually a couple of questions here.
Yeah, great question. We are on a path to maintain the full complement of athletic teams and programs at each of our universities. And so that obviously marries with the academic program. Right? It's important to understand that 75% of our students in all of these, in each of these combinations, 75% of our students are in 8 programs, right? And so obviously those 8 programs, you know, again, because the academic programs will be located where the students are, those programs, faculty instructing in those programs will be, will exist at each of the institutions. So I'm not concerned about student recruitment with respect to athletics. We have a great complement of teams, a great history of competition between them, and obviously other institutions through the PSAC, the Pennsylvania Conference that we belong to. And I would expect that to continue. And just to put a quick note on that, athletics has been a tremendous pathway for students, low and middle income students in particular. Students who would not otherwise have an opportunity to attend a university or a college do through athletics, and our athletes retain and graduate at higher rates than non-athletes. So for many reasons, they're a driver of educational success and frankly, social mobility. So it's really important to all of us to maintain those programs and to continue to see them flourish.
But I think Ronald's major or main question had to do with the overlap of majors and academic programs that are being offered. I think that, you know, a lot of people probably are trying to picture this because this is something that's relevant. Well, we know it's new here in Pennsylvania, but how do you keep from, will those schools, to ask, you know, repeat his question, will those schools maintain what have been, they've been known for over the years? You mentioned Mansfield and music, but will they continue to maintain those programs?
Yeah, so I guess I think about it this way. So where those, so we're looking at the 75% of students who are enrolled in the first, in the same eight, you know, the same eight programs, and they tend to be, you know, won't surprise you, things like, you know, business, education, et cetera. So it's just imagine those faculty providing instruction, those programs exist on all of our campuses. In other areas, which are niche areas, you would expect you would expect to see a greater differentiation or distribution. But I think of it in terms of combinations like in biology, or in chemistry, or in other name your subject. Not every university can afford the full breadth of subdisciplines. So you will see, for example, that in a program like biology, you might see evolutionary biology in one of the universities, whereas, you know, plant biology or animal biology might exist somewhere else. So this provides us with an opportunity to maintain the niche programs that have risen to, you know, have created real distinction for any number of our universities. Those programs in particular, the smaller ones, the ones that are threatened most by enrollment, are particularly threatened by the sort of decline that we've seen over the last number of years. So by pulling them together, again, we're able to provide, to integrate strengths that exist at each of the universities into programs which are just much more robust with respect to their overall enrollment.
Will there be occasion where students will have to travel to another campus? I mean, I was thinking about labs, for example. You mentioned biology, and I was thinking about the students that are involved in labs. Is that something that can be done remotely? I mean, we probably have learned a lot over the last year about doing things remotely.
Some labs can be done remotely. The technology in that particular arena is probably not as good, and the outcomes aren't as good as it would be in, for example, math or other hierarchically organized subjects. Although we're seeing some tremendous stuff coming out of places like Arizona State University, where they are doing some great work with, online, virtual. But we have committed that students will not need to travel for their in order to complete their degree programs, and we will abide by that commitment.
Will these universities have the same tuitions, or are there conditions that exist that will dictate that tuitions, room and board, that kind of thing will be different?
So that's a great question. So I think of this in terms of the total cost of attendance, Scott. The total cost of attendance for a student, that's money out of pocket for a degree, includes tuition, fees, which are largely charged at the campus level, you know, things for the rec center, et cetera, and room and board. That combination is what determines the total cost of attendance for a student. So at the moment, we already have differentiation in the total cost of attendance across our system. The least expensive is something like $20,000 a year, and the most expensive is something like $26,000 a year, and that is a result of variation in each of those three areas. Going forward, I would expect to see the institutions thinking about their tuition. You may expect to see differential rates in total cost of attendance because of difference in fees, room, and board. You know, and I think we need to explore different approaches to tuition. Depending on, you know, and we're already doing that through the use of scholarshiping and tuition discounting. Not all students pay the same rate. And that's intended to ensure that we're accessible to all of our students, that lower income students in particular have the same opportunities that others do with greater access to scholarship, et cetera. So I would expect to see that the current state would continue. That you will not see all students paying exactly the same total cost of attendance across the three, but also across all 14 of the universities.
This plan got unanimous approval by the Board of Governors last month, but you have gotten some pushback, and just an observation, it appears that most of the pushback has been from alumni of these schools. Have you considered their arguments?
Absolutely. We had a public review and comment period, which was 60 some days, and invited folks to write in. We had a website. We had any number of different public hearings. Four, I think we had public hearings, and then there were other public hearings put on by our faculty union. And, you know, we integrated and reviewed all the comments. It's about 1,000 in all. And they were tremendously important. And they resulted in pretty significant changes to the plan. The ones that I think of in terms of significant changes is that we prolonged the period of curriculum, I call it curriculum integration, curriculum blending. So we'll take 3 years to blend our curriculum as opposed to trying to do it all in one. And I think that was a great change. And I think it was the right thing to do, giving our faculty much more opportunity to really to build curricula that make the best possible sense, that take advantage of their distributed skills, et cetera. So I look forward to that. We conducted some market research into the willingness and expectations of students and their parents, frankly, with respect of online education, so we could make sure that we were operating within, you know, what would be considered to be normal in terms of expectations about exposure to online. We obviously did the economic impact study, which I referenced before, made any number of other changes, all of which are detailed again on our website. So the plans as submitted in finally for approval to the board in July were, you know, significantly evolved from the ones submitted initially in April. And that was entirely due to the public review process, which was a good one. And I'm grateful for it. And I'm grateful for the people who spent the time, frankly, and attention to understand the plans and to really think with us about, you know, how to make a better university system, and even to the folks who were, you know, obviously very much opposed to the board moving forward, you know, with the integration. They also offered real insight, and which we took very seriously.
I know you have to go, Chancellor. So one final question: what will success look like for this plan?
Well, for me, success looks like, you know, universities sort of remaining their vibrant selves, continuing to attract, the students, hopefully grow their student enrollments, to establish vibrant communities. I think there's a couple of other aspects which are central to the plans, which we haven't gotten an opportunity to talk about. You know, as the number of traditional students, I'll define those as students leaving high school, as that number has declined, there has been a tremendous growth in non-traditional students who really need our help. And whether they are adults who are looking simply to refresh their skills, maybe not with a degree, but with a certificate, or whether they're students who are looking for fully online option, 57,000 Pennsylvanians every year enroll in a fully online program provided by an out-of-state provider. So we're missing those opportunities. They need our help too. They need a public option too. And so our integrations also provide us with an opportunity to reach into, okay, I'll call them new markets, but let's call them new student groups who need a public higher education option, and we can provide them one. So I guess it comes down for me to the maintaining the vibrancy of each of our universities, the outcomes that we're seeing of our students, graduation retention rates, I would expect those to improve. Have better diversity in terms of not just the number of students who were enrolling, but obviously have consistency in their graduation rates, and then the opportunity to move into these new areas to really provide the help, not just for the students, frankly, but for the economy of Pennsylvania, which needs to see more and more people with the kinds of skills and competencies that only a higher education can provide.
I'll just leave it with one comment from listener Jim. Says, I graduated Edinburgh in 1967. My great-grandmother graduated in 1872. I support the change. So there's a testimonial for you. Dan Greenstein, Chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott. Always a pleasure.
The 2020 Summer Olympics in Tokyo that were postponed until this summer are now history. 19 athletes from Pennsylvania participated in the games, including our guest today, 17-year-old Casey Coughold of Lancaster County. She finished 17th in the archery competition. Ms. Coughold is still competing. She's now in Poland and joins us. Casey Coughold, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So where in Poland are you?
I am in Wrocław, Poland right now. I've been here for about a day.
And what's the competition?
It is the Youth World Championship, so it's all athletes under 21.
Have you competed
for,
yet?
For archery.
Okay. Have you competed yet?
We will start competition tomorrow. Today was practice.
Okay. So, all right. So we'll talk about that a little bit, but want to talk about your Olympic experience. First of all, congratulations making the team. This just had to be the experience of a lifetime. Tell us about it.
Yeah, thank you. It really was the experience of a lifetime. It was my first games, so I really just wanted to take it all in and remember each specific event and each day, because it's like the biggest thing I've done in my life so far. So I really wanted to just cherish every shot, cherish every day. And it was a great experience. I enjoyed having the whole team there. We had 6 athletes on the USA Archery team go. And so I got really close with them because we couldn't really leave the village. So we were kind of stuck together in a sense. So definitely some good team bonding. And it was great to shoot on the Olympic field and in that big stadium. And I just think overall it was a great experience that I can apply to a lot of competitions in the future.
Well, this was your first Olympics, so you really have nothing to compare it to, except maybe some international competitions. But being, you know, kept in the Olympic village with just your archery teammates, what was that like?
It was interesting not being able to leave the village because three of the athletes on our archery team had previously gone to an Olympic Games. And so they kind of, from what I've heard about an Olympic experience, you can leave the village, go sightsee, all that. And we just didn't get to experience that part. But it was good to stay in the village and meet other athletes. Like, I met people like Caleb Dressel and Simone Biles, which was really nice. So I got to see other people as well. Just I wasn't able to leave the athlete village.
Hmm. You say you met Simone Biles and Caleb Kessel. I mean, you share your teammates on the American USA Olympic team. Do you share kind of a sisterhood, if you will?
A little bit. I didn't get to meet like too many athletes, but the team that I had there for archery, like, we all bonded really well. Each night we would do something fun. Like, one night we watched a movie, another night we played cards. Like, it was good to kind of create more of a friendship with those girls.
Hmm. If you're just tuning in, our guest is Casey Caulfield from Lancaster County, Conestoga Valley. She will be a senior at Conestoga Valley this year. We'll talk a little bit about that in just a moment. Just got back from Tokyo. She went from Tokyo to back home to Lancaster County, and now she is in Poland competing again. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So let's talk about the competition itself. What were your expectations going in?
I expected to be a little nervous going into the competition just because I've never had as much pressure as the Olympics puts on. Like, in my head, I knew it was going to feel different than a normal competition. So going into the competition, I just wanted to trust myself and shoot good shots. And I had experienced teammates there that could help me along the way as well.
So you were expecting that kind of pressure and being nervous. So were you?
I definitely was. The first day we do a qualification round, and for that I wasn't as nervous, but once we did the matches, the head-to-head matches in the arena, that definitely got to my nerves. It was different for me to shoot on such a big stage. Like, I've done individual matches on a stage before, just nothing quite like the Olympics.
Mm. So how do you control those nerves? I mean, Casey, you're 17. So, I mean, are you the youngest member of the team, by the way?
Yes, I am the youngest member of the team. So how I control my nerves is I just kind of center myself on my process and don't think about, like, who's watching, what my competitor is doing. I just focus on myself, because in that moment, all I can control is what I do. So I really try and focus on what I'm doing instead of whatever is going on around me.
Hmm. You've been doing this since you've been shooting since you were 2 years old. Your parents own an archery supply store in Lancaster County. I drove by just the other day. But you've been doing this for a long time. When you say that you just have to concentrate, I mean, is there a side of you that says, well, I pretty much know what I'm doing here. I just have to concentrate on what I'm doing.
Yeah, there is a little part of that where it's like, I know how to shoot a bow. I've done it for so long. And so you just have to center yourself back to what you know and do what you know best and trust it.
Hmm. So, you know, for those who may not be familiar with the archery competition, can you explain how it worked and, you know, what's your specialty? What are you best at?
So a normal archery competition, there's a qualification round that sets you into brackets. So for the Olympics, there are 64 archers in each division. So those 64 archers will shoot a 72-arrow qualification round. And then from that, first we'll shoot against 64th, second against 63rd, and so on going down that bracket. And there are other events such as mixed team and team rounds. Mixed team is a man shooting with a woman against another country. And then team rounds is three of the same division shooting against another three of the same division. So like women's team against women's team and men's team against men's team. And then there's the individual matches as well. And I'm a fan of the individual matches. I think it's a lot of fun to kind of go head to head, like even though the other matches are head to head, but just being an individual against another individual, I think that's the most fun. And yeah, I just get up there, you shoot three arrows at a time in matches. So I really try and focus in when I'm shooting those sorts of matches.
You know, I'm glad to hear you use the word fun, because I mean, as I said, you've been shooting your almost your entire life, and so you obviously enjoy it. But even with that added pressure, even with that nervousness that you talked about, was it fun?
It was fun for sure. I mean, I've never been to an Olympic Games, so for me, I wanted to have a good time. I wanted to have a good experience and have fun. Just because I enjoy doing what I do. So to me, it was fun for sure.
I mean, were you thinking, boy, this is a lot of fun during the competition? Did you have time to think about that? Or did you realize afterwards that, oh, that was a lot of fun?
I think more afterwards is when I realized it, because in the moment you're all serious and ready to go. And then once I had some downtime and was able to reflect on it, I came to think like, wow, that was awesome. That was a lot of fun. I genuinely like had a great time there. And so I'm super happy to have my first games be a good experience.
We have a couple questions from listeners. One says, the South Koreans have dominated the sport for a long time. In fact, they took all the medals. Did you watch them compete, and did you take anything away from that?
Yeah, the South Koreans have definitely dominated, especially archery in the past Olympics. And it's always good to watch them because you can learn a lot just about how they carry themselves, the way the coaches work, how they work as a team. And it's neat to see them be successful for so long. But I can tell you that the Americans are looking to give them some competition in 2024.
Are you looking forward to 2024 already?
I am, yeah. So this Olympic cycle is only 3 years since the games was postponed. Usually an Olympic cycle is every 4 years. So we start our trials in only a year and a half. So there's really not a big break to have some downtime. So I'll keep working throughout the season.
We have a question from Sarah, who asks, would you ask Casey if she's had interview training by the Olympic Committee, or she's just naturally poised? She must be doing a lot of interviews, asking probing questions.
Yeah, so I've not really had any preparation other than things I've done in the past. I started competing nationally when I was about 12 or 13. So since then I've been doing interviews. So at a young age, I've had to learn kind of how to think on my feet, but still be respectful and give thoughtful answers.
Well, you certainly are doing that. I mean, just wonderful having an opportunity to talk with you. Here's another question. As a RISE senior, you're probably thinking about college. Are there schools that offer archery as a varsity sport? Do you want to do this in college?
Yes, I am looking forward to college. Since I'm a senior, I'm going to start applying this year. And Texas A&M is probably one of the best schools in the country for archery. My brother goes there, actually, and my boyfriend, he just got in, so he'll be joining as well in the fall. So overall, they have a great team. They've had a lot of success in the past. I think they're working on their this was their 11th national title in a row. So they've had a lot of success in the archery field. So I'm definitely looking forward to hopefully being there next year.
I mean, have they recruited you? Have the Aggies recruited you?
I know the coach very well there. And so he's been on my tail since I was about 12 years old about getting me on the team. So I'm excited to be able to work with him, and I'm sure he's looking forward to having me on the team as well. So once I get back to normal, get back into the school routine, I'll reach out to him and get my applications done.
Do they offer scholarships in archery?
They do. So a lot of schools that have archery as like a more of a club or varsity sport offer them, like James Madison University does, Texas A&M, the Cumberlands in Kentucky do, and there are a couple others that have big archery teams that do offer scholarships.
So we mentioned that you're about to enter your senior year at Conestoga Valley. I read a quote where you said you want to be as normal as possible. You're an Olympian and you're a world-class archer. How do you maintain normalcy during your senior year?
I'm just going to try and be as much of a normal kid as possible. Like, I know I travel a lot and do all these crazy things, but I'm still a kid, you know? So I want to have a normal high school experience for 1 year at least. Like, I'll do all in-school classes. I've been doing mostly online my high school years. So I'm really looking forward to doing actually in-school classes where I can talk with the teachers, interact with other kids, and hopefully join clubs and do those sorts of things as well.
Will you have time to train if you're involved in a lot of activities like that?
So the way I have my schedule set up for my senior year is really nice. For the first semester, I believe I only have 3 classes. So I have 2 classes in the morning and then a break in the middle of the day that I can go home, practice, eat lunch, and then come back for my last class. And that gives me enough time to train while it's still daylight out, because the farther the year goes along, the earlier it gets dark. So I'll be able to train in the middle of the day and still get schoolwork done at night.
How do you train other than continuously shoot?
So like any sport, archery is physical and mental. So other than just shooting, there's a lot of mental preparation that goes into it, such as journaling, working with my coach, setting goals and all that, just to keep me mentally sound while I'm still physically preparing.
What do you want to get better at?
That's a good question. I think I need to get a little bit better at performing on stage. Like I said, you get nervous when you're on a stage, and although I've shot in many finals matches, everyone is different. So just being able to control those nerves a little bit better and still feel my normal shot up on the stage is something I still need to improve at.
I had a listener ask this question. You're in Poland now. What other countries have you visited for competitions, and do you have a favorite?
Oh, I have visited many countries. I'll list a few. I've been to Luxembourg, France, Italy, Spain, Colombia, Peru, Guatemala, the Netherlands, Turkey, China, Japan. That's all I can think of off the top of my head. And now Poland. Out of those, I'd say my favorite would probably be the Netherlands. The people were just really nice, and they had a lot of cute little shops and really good ice cream. That's what stood out to me most.
Well, that's good to hear. If I'm ever in the Netherlands, I have to get some ice cream. Well, Casey,
yeah, for sure.
I want to first of all congratulate you on being on the Olympic team, and I'm glad to hear that you had so much fun, and look forward to seeing you again in 2024 at the Olympics. But Casey Caulfield of Lancaster County, thank you very much for being with us today, and again, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.